The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2023 Walter Magazine. We begin with the cover story, Smoke and Fire. A new cookbook from Ed and Ryan Mitchell explores barbecue traditions by Anne-Monique Clark. This month, pitmaster Ed Mitchell and his son Ryan Mitchell released Ed Mitchell's Barbecue. It's a cookbook that's less a how-to than an exploration of the craft. What are the roots of barbecue? Who honed the techniques and why? Can the next generation embrace this tradition and move it forward? Throughout the book, the Mitchells emphasize that the flavors and traditions of barbecue, cooking slowly, dousing meat in strong sauces, pickling trotters and snouts, were a response to a need. Whole hog barbecue is a form of survival, a means to feed a group of people, says Ryan. Essays and historical photos drive the point home. Ryan and Ed will be on a book tour this summer and plan to open a new restaurant in Raleigh, The Preserve, late this year. They found a location off Wake Forest Road that's zoned both industrial and commercial, so they can cook a whole hog on site, the way it's been done for generations. Just like in the cookbook, they hope the restaurant will encourage folks to come together and get a fuller appreciation for a long, undersung craft. We wanted to make sure we highlighted the origin of barbecue and give voices to the people who really started it, says Ryan. We wanted to paint a picture, but also tell the truth and give some motivation at the same time. Barbecue is too inclusive to be divisive. The following is an excerpt from the book titled I Can't Give Up by Ed Mitchell. Wilson, North Carolina, is no stranger to barbecue. I would say our small rural town is a founding bedrock to the tradition of whole hog barbecue and growing tobacco. However, starting in the 1960s, most barbecue restaurants were using store-bought pork shoulders, cooked over gas instead of coal fires, and the flavor wasn't the same. I had no idea that my family's Eastern North Carolina barbecue would take me around the world to become one of the most internationally recognized barbecue pitmasters. From 2002 until 2018, I was invited year after year to headline the Big Apple Barbecue Block Party in New York City. Famous food writers like Michael Pollan and Peter Kaminsky and chefs like Anthony Bourdain and Bobby Flay traveled to Wilson to learn how Ed Mitchell, Willie and Doretha's son, cooked whole hogs the traditional way. For me, barbecue has always been synonymous with celebrations. When I was a kid in the 1950s, we barbecued to celebrate family achievements and things like the end of the tobacco harvest season. It was the only time during my childhood when blacks and whites ate side by side. For a brief moment, we were colorblind, and I never forgot that feeling. The next time I experienced it was in Vietnam, when guys around me were being wounded and killed. The only way we were going to get home alive, beside our prayers, was by watching one another's backs. I've realized that when we have a common need to exist, everything else goes out the window. Color, ethnicity, religion, gender, anything that can be divisive. Barbecue still has that power. Today, you see black, whites, and every color eating barbecue together. So why are only a handful of African-American entrepreneurs barbecuing whole hog today? Rodney Scott in Hemingway, South Carolina, Dr. Howard Conyers in Manning, South Carolina, and Brian Furman in Atlanta, Georgia are some of the great ones. After I decided barbecue was my career and legacy, I got in it to win it. When we designed our menu, we were intentional about adding dishes that we served in our home, traditional dishes that so many Black families in Wilson ate at home or at a pig pickin', a traditional North Carolina barbecue. My son Ryan got involved out of necessity. Now that Mitchell's Barbecue was a full-time job, we needed all hands on deck. My decision to team up with my son was strategic. The minute he showed interest in my work, I wanted him involved, because barbecue has always been a family affair to me. I wanted him to come home after he experienced working for corporate America. I needed Ryan's help to move this family business forward. Today, I barbecue to show young African Americans that our history lies in those embers. I wear overalls and a baseball cap, like those worn by my grandfather, Lawyer Sanders, and other Black men from previous generations, to remind me of the sacrifices of the men who wore this uniform, who worked the land, and provided for their families. It makes me realize that the work I do, while it can seem futile at times, is important. After all, I am one of the last barbecue pitmasters who knows how to cook a whole hog like my ancestors did. That was an excerpt from Ed Mitchell's Barbecue by Ed Mitchell and Ryan Mitchell, published by Echo on June 6, 2023. This article was edited for Time. From the noted department, DIY Dad, a tribute to an amateur architect and weekend builder, by Billy Warden. 50 years ago, my father conscripted my grumbling brothers and me into building of a stone monument. China has its Great Wall. Rome has its Colosseum. North Raleigh boasts Big Bill's mighty bulwark. At 4 feet high and 50 yards long, this retaining wall is composed of roughly 1,000 basketball-sized boulders. It still stands today, dutifully preventing the suburban lawn outside our former home from sliding onto the sidewalk and street below. This was only the beginning of Dad's do-it-yourself building spree. In the coming decade and a half, my father would muster his often reluctant brood to construct a sprawling deck, a seemingly endless stockade fence, an entire spare room, an arched pergola with a rollback swing, floor-to-ceiling built-in bookshelves, a second pergola swooping over a home-poured patio, and an ill-fated tool shed. Now 79, my dad, Bill, is a ranking member of an industrious army of amateur architects, product designers, and builders who first took up hammers and screwdrivers in the DIY surge of the mid-20th century. Popular Mechanics magazine, pretty much modern DIY's Book of Genesis, had debuted way back in 1902, extolling the practical and recreational value of making your own stuff. But two world wars and a depression stinted the supply of time and materials DIY demands. The end of World War II, however, brought returning GIs newly schooled in gritty self-reliance. This, combined with economic prosperity, the rise of home ownership, and a bungling sense of optimism, rallied young families to literally build their dream futures. My dad, an accountant Monday through Friday, came by the DIY habit, arguably an obsession, early. His father, my grandfather Lefty, had recruited able army pals to help erect his budding family's first home from the ground up, upon returning from the battlefields of Europe in World War II. Perhaps inspired by this pedigree, Dad's own construction campaigns took on the character of a military operation. Early in the week, he'd cast a calculating gaze at some unsuspecting swath of yard, like General Patton eyeing an enemy stronghold. Then, come Thursday or Friday evening, he'd hunch over the kitchen table, sketching on a sheet of paper torn from one of our school notebooks. On Saturday morning, he'd golf, and our little neighborhood would be at peace. But upon returning home, he'd march us boys into our faux wood paneled Pontiac station wagon to hunt and gather at the nearby construction sites, lumber yards, and Ace Hardware. Saturday afternoon and Sunday, we'd build. Dad's conscriptions could be overridden in just three ways. First, by a Category 4 or above hurricane. Second, by illness. Not just signs of a head cold, but actually bleeding from the eyes and ears. Finally, by the intervention of my sainted mother, Nancy, announcing that one of us brothers in arms must go with her to JCPenney or Kmart to shop for school supplies or new clothes. Of course, slipping away like this brought the scorn of the abandoned brothers, but Mom made sure each would eventually have his leave of duty. On Father's Day, however, even Mom would join the drilling and cement mixing, and she would openly admire all the things that were in plain sight, but too often lost on us boys. How imaginative Dad was in blithely ad-libbing his way through unforeseen glitches and near disasters. How patient he was in teaching us skills we could never quite master. How handsome the finished work was, except for the aforementioned tool shed, which eventually collapsed due to a brown ocean of rain sloshing atop its fatally flat roof. None of us grew up to be weekend builders per se, but Raymond took to constructing his own electric guitars en route to a career in music. Christopher just bought a house in the country, where he foresees much backyard puttering. And I like to think that the many journalism pieces I've authored are, in a way, sawdust-free construction projects, complete with the occasional conniption of cursing that Dad also specialized in. My folks now live in the dream home that Dad designed for their retirement in 2010. His plans for the contractors included an unfinished second floor. Naturally, almost as soon as the professionals cleared out, Dad proceeded to finish the upper level himself with stupefying care and flair. Puzzling over the logic of sending the pros home only to bootstrap a major project solo is beside the point. Adventures in DIY don't have to make sense. They just need to make the creators happy and the lives of the people around them a little richer. Mission accomplished, Dad. This article was edited for Time. And next, Go Fish. Big Rock is a sport fishing competition with humble roots and surprising fervor by Anne-Monique Clark. The Big Rock competition started small. In the spring of 1957, a group of Morehead City fishing enthusiasts partnered with local businesses to gather a cash prize for whoever could catch a blue marlin off the Crystal Coast. Up to that point, the billfish had only been rumored in the waters. It took months, but by mid-September, Raleigh angler Jimmy Croy, fishing aboard the Mary Z with Captain Bill Olson, caught a 143-pound blue marlin. They radioed back to shore on their way to the harbor, and when they arrived, a raucous crowd had gathered. This fishing contest became an annual tradition. Over the years, the rules became formalized, and the prizes grew. In 1972, the competition was renamed Big Rock, after a prime spot in the Gulf Stream for finding blue marlin. Now in its 65th year, it enlists about 200 boats and nearly 1,600 competitors, and the purse is in the millions. For many in Raleigh and along the coast, it's a much-anticipated tradition. When I was a kid, my mother would deliver me to the tournament, and I'd watch the guys bring the fish in, says Tommy Bennett, a Moorhead City native, longtime Big Rock board member, and past president of the organization. Fighting a blue marlin was always a dream. The competition attracts both full-time anglers and avid amateur fishermen. For some, Big Rock is one stop on a circuit of fishing contests from Bermuda up the East Coast. The prize is for the heaviest blue marlin. The competition lasts 6 days. Each boat fishes four of them. Every day the leaderboard changes, so boats know not to bring in a 400-pound marlin if, say, third place already weighs in at 500 pounds. The catch? You can't weigh the fish until you get to shore, which adds to the drama. You can measure them, and experienced fishermen can ballpark the weight on deck. 95% of the fish that are caught are released. Neil Sykes, who lives in Virginia Beach, is the captain of the Mercenaria, a 72-foot Viking whose owner, Chad Ballard, won the grand prize last year. Ballard pulled in the 572.6-pound blue marlin on the first day. It made for a long week, says Sykes, who says he's been fishing these waters all his life. We look for eddies where water splits off from the Gulf Stream, where temperature breaks hold fish. The captains talk amongst themselves about where people were catching the day before, sharing tips or not. Everybody's friends, but sometimes people get a little more tight-lipped, Sykes says. Raleigh resident David Perung has fished the Big Rock for decades alongside his friend J.J. Watt Johnson and their captain, Jay Watson, on the Widespread, a 51-foot Crown Marine. We all like to hang out together. We're strategic about the fishing, but we like to have fun, he says. He credits Watson for knowing where to fish. He makes the decisions. As Perung's three sons have gotten older, they've joined the team and made some amazing catches. Each of my three kids has killed a fish in the last 3 years, Perung says. In fact, it was Perung's son, Cole, who caught the winning fish in 2021, a blue marlin that weighed in at 656.5 pounds. It took Cole 4 hours to reel in that winning marlin. His hands were totally destroyed, but we knew it was a winner, says Perung. Fish have to weigh in by midnight. For the Widespread, it was a race to the finish. The fire department sent trucks to light the dock where an enthusiastic crowd had gathered. Hundreds of people staring at you, microphones and cameras in your face. It's a lot, says Sykes. Big Rock also includes a lady anglers competition for female fishermen, a junior anglers element, and the Big Rock Hero program that pairs active duty military with fishing boats. Big Rock hosts parties and other entertainment during the competition, and the boats themselves are an attraction, from large center console boats to sport fishing boats to small ones with outboard motors. Further from shore, folks can follow along on social media or the internet. For about 10 days of the year, the entire world of sport fishing is focused on North Carolina, says Bennett, You can watch your buddy weigh in from your computer in Raleigh. The organization has also made strides in conservation, creating weight limits to release fish that won't make the grade to reduce the number of blue marlin brought to shore. They've also made charitable giving a huge component of the competition, donating $7.5 million to area charities as of 2022. Big Rock is more than a fishing competition. It's a community booster and a family event. As Perrin says, the fishing is great. The catching is a bonus, especially if you can get back to Moorhead City in time to weigh in. This article was edited for Time. And from The Simple Life, Return of Jimmy the Lawn King, Fresh Cut Grass Stirs Up Memories by Jim Dotson. It started with a simple phone call from our neighbors across the street. Mildred Horseman had seen me mowing my family's yard and wondered if I might be willing to mow her lawn. Her husband, Jean, was just home from the hospital and under strict doctor's orders to rest for a month. She even offered to pay. It was early summer, 1968, and I was 15. We were new to an old neighborhood where everybody had lush green lawns. I'd been mowing lawns since age 12, trusted not to destroy anything or chop off my own toes. "I'll send Jimmy right over," said my mom. "No need to pay him. He loves mowing the grass." That was partly true. I liked mowing grass. I also liked money, which I needed to buy the beautiful classical guitar I had my eye on at Moore Music Company. It was a whopping $95, $800 in today's currency. So I went off with our old crotchety Sears power mower, which normally took forever and required a number of impolite muttered oaths to start. Mr. Horseman sat on his screened porch watching me unsuccessfully crank until I had to rest my arm. He finally got up and stepped outside. "Jimmy," he said, "come with me. I've got just what you need." In his garage sat a bright green Lawn Boy power mower, one of the most beautiful things I'd ever seen. "She's got a few years of age on her, but we'll almost always start on the first pull. I keep her tuned up." He was right. One pull and she started. Mr. Horseman went back to his club chair on the porch, and I got busy on his lawn, marveling at the way his Lawn Boy cut grass. When I finished and put his mower back in the garage, he waved me onto the porch. Mrs. Horseman had brought out lemonade. "So what do you think?" "Great," I said. "Wish my dad would get one of those." "They're pretty reliable," he said. "One of the oldest brands in America, invented by a guy who built motors for boats." As I drank my lemonade, I learned Mr. Horseman was a retired business professor from Michigan. The Lawn Boy mower, he explained, was created before World War II by a Wisconsin man who built Evinrude outboard engines. He became quite the successful businessman. Mr. Horseman handed me a $10 bill. Sadly, I was compelled to explain that I was unable to take his money due to a mother who didn't care a fig if I became a successful businessman. "In that case," he said, "how about we do a deal? You mow my lawn this summer, and you can use the Lawn Boy to mow lawns along the street. Sound good? I'll even buy the gas." It did sound good, a potential gold mine at $10 a clip, but I didn't know any of the neighbors yet. "Print up some flyers," he said, "or better yet, I'll have Mildred get on the phone. You'll have a job or two in no time." Within a week, I had two paying jobs and a half dozen regulars by the middle of summer. I was the richest kid on the block. By July, the Yamaha Classical was mine. My mom took to calling me Jimmy the Yard King. It was my first real job. I also had my first real crush that summer on a cute girl from Luther League named Ginny Silkworth. Ginny had a great laugh and a solid right hook. When I asked her to go to the movies, she laughed and punched me sharply in the arm. We went to see Franco Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet at the cinema on Tate Street near UNCG, an evening somewhat diminished by the fact that my father had to drive us to the theater and never stopped chatting with my date. That summer was long and hot for America, one of the most tumultuous in the nation. But it was also the summer that Jenny and I went to see The Graduate. The Beatles released Hey Jude, and I snagged a second job teaching guitar to kids and senior citizens at Mr. Weinstein's music store. Between mowing and teaching, my pockets overflowed. I started saving money to buy my first car. And something about the orderliness and smell of fresh-cut grass and the satisfaction of a job well done permeated my teenage brain. It grounded me in a way that made my narrow world seem oddly immune from all the bad news on TV. It was the first and last great year of Jimmy the Yard King, though its impact was lasting. Perhaps this explains why, when my wife and I built our first home in Maine, I created a garden that featured more than half an acre of beautiful Kentucky bluegrass and fescues. Today, back in the old neighborhood where I started, I own a modest suburban patch of grass I can mow with my Honda self-propelled mower in less than 18 minutes. Sometimes when I'm cutting grass, I think about that faraway summer and my laughing first date. Ginny and I stayed in touch for 4 decades. She became a beloved teacher in Philadelphia and passed away a few years ago. I miss her laugh, if not her punch. Maybe the smell of fresh-cut summer grass does that. Whatever it is, if only for 18 minutes once a week, Jimmy the Yard King is back in business. This article was edited for Time. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Walter Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.